Is your team not performing well? Is morale low and turnover high? Are you falling further behind the competition? I'm here to help. I'm your host, Shaney, and this is The Leadership Show, where business strategy and culture finally meet, and we make the long-awaited shift from rhetoric to results. I promise I'm not your typical boring leadership consultant, and I will help you get your shift together. Let's do this. Hello, Leadershifters, and welcome to another episode of The Leadershifter Show with yours truly, Shaney. It is my special privilege today to introduce you to our guest, Chuck Garcia. And I told him to be patient because I have many bullet points by way of introduction that I think are super important to highlight. So feel free to blush at any time, Chuck. But so, Chuck is a former Wall Streeter like I am, spent 25 years doing various things, including working at Bloomberg. And I know we're going to touch on that. And he also worked at some well-known shops like BlackRock and Citadel. But most recently, he is the founder of Climb Leadership International, which is literal and figurative or metaphorical, because climb, which is what he likes to help leaders do in his coaching business and his public speaking practice, and climb because he is a mountaineer. So once again, the commonalities between the two of us, although I think of myself less of a mountaineer and more of a rock climber, but a lot of the skills are similar, and the places that we get to see that most of the world do not is what makes it so special. Chuck is an author. His book is called A Climb to the Top, and it's even been translated into Chinese, where it's been used to sell to train locals there on Western style leadership and communication. He also has a podcast called A Climb to the Top, Stories of Transformation. And we will talk about his own transformation and maybe some highlights of things that he's heard on his podcast. So stay tight, folks, because we've got a broad swath of topics to cover today. Welcome to the show, Chuck. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Shaney, it's a pleasure being here. And thank you for the opportunity to join your program.
Yes. So let's get right into it, which is you know, selfishly, I would actually love you to share first your story about how you got into mountaineering.
Yeah, it was, I'll say, unexpected. I was fortunate enough to have grown up in a winter wonderland. So I grew up skating, skiing, and looking at the mountains. It always appealed to me, but I never knew exactly beyond skiing what it would offer. And somewhere along the line, when I was in my upper 30s and I was flying around the world a lot, I had a lot of time to read, and I read a book called Into Thin Air. And it accounted the 1996 Everest disaster. And unlike when most people, many who read it said, the last thing I'm going to do is climb a mountain, it was had the exact opposite effect on me. It just gnawed at me like, wow, I certainly didn't welcome a disaster on a mountain, but the entire way Krakauer laid out mountaineering just had this visceral appeal. One thing led to another, and on September 11th, 2001, I was scheduled to speak at the World Trade Center that afternoon.
No way.
No kidding. And unfortunately, I was with Bloomberg at the time, and three of my colleagues in their younger 20s were in the building and were setting up the Bloomberg terminals in the service of what would be my speech a little bit later in the day. Well, we all know what happened that day, and unfortunately, my Bloomberg mates never made it out of the building. And I spent the next month going to 16 funerals and memorial services. But it had a deep impact on me because I was on a dead list for several hours. I was unaccounted for, and I was assumed in the building and in the World Trade Center. I wasn't. I was actually on the way. And when I made it back to the Bloomberg office and I was accounted for, it hit me, the realization of what just happened, because my wife and my brother and my brothers knew I was going to speak that afternoon. They had called Bloomberg in a panic. Have you seen Chuck? We don't know where he is. And I'll cut right to it. That was an incredible time of introspection, of sadness, but also I didn't want that time to go in vain. I didn't want the death of my friends and my mates and so many people that I had known that we had lost. there was something burning inside of me that said, I have to do something to honor the spirit of these wonderful people. And I didn't know why, but having just read Into Thin Air, I said, I am going to do something I've always thought about. I never did. And here I am thinking about, how do I honor their spirit? I don't know. I don't know how to do it, but there's something about the mountains. So exactly 1 year later, on 9/11/2002, I stood on the summit of Mount Rainier. And the date of that wasn't exactly planned. That was just cosmic. I just wanted to go in early September.
Totally, because you can't plan the summit day.
Indeed. And we did summit on 9/11, and it was cosmic. But Shani, you know that when you hit a summit, there's a book. And you can sign into the book. And I signed in the names of my lost brethren at Bloomberg. And what I didn't know, though, standing on that summit and then making it home, there was just something, a spirit in the air. I don't know exactly how to explain it. But I was away from New York. I was away from my family. I was with a bunch of climbing people like-minded to me. And there was something in the hours of the cold and the step at a time, something about it really got into my soul. And when I went home that day, I said, you know, a couple of days later, we made it down, a successful summit bid, a wonderful experience. It was collaborative. It was individualistic. It was so many things wrapped up into one. On my way home, I said, I don't know what's next, but long story short, a year later, I stood on the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. Then I climbed the Matterhorn. I went to the Andes in Alaska. But what it really did, it wasn't just something that was this physical embodiment of how we spend our time. It was soulful. It was mindful. And every time I stepped up and down a mountain, it was just impacting me every little bit at a time that ultimately led, Shani, to me making the conclusion on a mountain in Alaska that from here on in, I am going to dedicate my life in the service of someone else's success, not mm-hmm. just mine. I've been guided up mountains, I've been guided down mountains, and now I want to guide people up and down their proverbial mountains, and how blessed am I to do it.
Amen. And what you just described is the definition of great leadership, right?
I appreciate that.
Helping guide others to success. And I wish more people got that and let go of the ego and their need to make the imprint and realize that the best leaders are fashioning other leaders as they go.
Well, one of the things I think you and I both learn, I'm assuming you feel the way I do, that mountain is bigger than any one of us. And the mountain doesn't care about us. The mountain doesn't feel for us if we fall into a crevasse. But what we feel for the mountain is an enormity of respect. Like, wow, look at this thing. And what we realize when we're at the bottom of a mountain and we're looking up, the world is much bigger than me. It's much bigger than you. And yet when you coalesce with your team, and Kilimanjaro, using his example, there were 13 of us who climbed on the team and 36 porters in the support of our summit. Yep. So what an amazing privilege that was for 36 people I'd never met, didn't know who they were. We show up in Tanzania and they're doing everything in their power in the service of our success.
Yep.
And as I thought about that, I said, what a blessing this is. Look at what they're doing in the service of my success. All I got to do is get to the top. They're feeding us and pitching our tents. That had a big impact on me because just that experience alone was great leadership in what I saw on that mountain. And I said, if I can bring home a little bit of that sentiment and I can turn that metaphor and help people, because I realized I when I told people I climb mountains, everyone looked at me like I was insane.
I know.
And yet it's the most sanest thing I've ever done because you're in the service of other people. You're working as a team. You're taking mm-hmm. a step at a time. I've lost friends in car accidents, and I being on the mountain, it's not that I didn't feel I wasn't taking a risk. I learned more from those mountain climbs than I ever did in a textbook or in college. So it does something to your spirit.
Absolutely.
And I am eternally grateful in spite of whatever tragedy came out of the catalyst that led me to the mountains. The gratitude that I express toward the opportunity to do what I've done, what choice do I have but to give it all to other people in the service of their success?
Yes. Well, sadly, that's often what catalyzes people to make big changes and perspective shifts is something tragic happened. And it's one of the reasons I picked up rock climbing. I was in a long-term relationship with a man I was supposed to marry when I was in my 20s in New York. Unexpectedly, he was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer, died in our apartment 7 months later. And it lit a fire in me of like, holy shit, like, we don't know how much time we have. And, you know, instead of like focusing all my efforts on wanting to be a partner at Goldman Sachs with like, what payoff? Only financial in the process, what part of their soul, of your soul are they taking, you know, even a good firm like that. And I started reprioritizing my life and it's been an adventure ever since. And I took up skiing, I took up climbing, I started jumping out of airplanes. Like it like released this, any fear that I had about doing those kind of things was like gone.
And well, in your case, did you, it sounds like you experimented with a few different things as part of your discovery. Is that a fair statement?
It is. And a lot of them stuck, you know, and I would say, though, that rock climbing is, I name it as one of my core values. And people say, Heidi, rock climbing is not a value. It's a sport and a really dangerous sport at that. And I'm like, you don't get it. Rock climbing to me is just a label on an experience and a feeling that I seek as part of fulfillment in my life.
And yeah.
I can't get in many other places besides when I'm in the mountains, in these beautiful places, in nature, feeling like achieving while at the same time feeling the gift of insignificance.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's something else. I'm with you on rock climbing because I learned to rock climb in preparation for what became more mountaineering. Rock climbing was my first stop on the journey. But what you're describing is something happened to me as I was rock climbing that I've never had before. In spite of I've tried yoga, I'm a distance runner. So in my 20s, I was a marathoner. And that really, that helped a lot because you have the same mindset when you're on the mountain. It's an endurance. It's a step at a time. Some moments are better than others, but you breathe through it. But when I was rock climbing, it's the only instance of anything I've ever done, including yoga, which I'm not very good at. But when I'm on a rock and I'm on a hold and I have a challenging thing ahead of me, and you're trying to be the good chess player.
Yep.
Rock climbing, I can say, is the only thing I've ever done where I 100% shut the ticker tape off in my head.
Yes.
Right. That's it. And maybe like if you're in a good movie, if you're in a huge movie theater and you see a Meryl Streep or Tom Hanks and you're completely lost, give the movies that, but the movie is over in 90 minutes. Whereas when you're on the rock, once you trust the system, you trust the rope, you trust your guide, the fear is gone. There's no fear. But what you're trying to do is get to the next hold. And sometimes I remember on one instance, I climbed in the place called the Shawgunks, which is 2 hours.
Oh, north. I know the Gunks. I just climbed there.
And I remember that's where I started. And I remembered on my first attempt, it took me in only one move, about 20 minutes. But what I learned from that, it was just a technically difficult thing. Yep. But what I learned is I had a guide above me who was unbelievably patient. Mm-hmm. He was with me. He encouraged me. He knew I was in a challenging place and that sooner or later, if I put my mind to it, forget the feet, forget the hands, it's the mindset. And what I remember and what was great leadership was his just that inspiring, no, it's okay, Chuck, you're going to get through it. Look at it differently. Step back a little bit. Look at the rock. You're going to get through this. Try your left hand, try your right hand. Just that moment of the only thing on the earth at that moment was me on a rock and someone leading me who cared enough about me to encourage me to take the next step. We weren't even concerned about summits. We didn't care. We were just taking this one at a time. I couldn't do it alone. But never in my life did I ever feel like everything went away right then and there. And that became my meditative state.
Yeah.
Right.
So you crazy. Too. I describe you rock climbing as meditative too. And again, most people don't get it. And what comes from being in the zone that way is you see solutions, routes, a hold, a maneuver, you know, that you didn't see at first. Right. So you're also, I mean, the analogies of rock climbing to business are endless, really. And it's why we could go on and on with this. So I so appreciate you sharing your experience and enthusiasm for me with us.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I also want to pause for a second and say, folks, I know not all of you are going to go take up rock climbing and mountaineering right now, and that's okay. That's not the point. The point is, what gives you passion? What lights you up? What else in your life that you love can you form your own analogies for to inform your leadership and the way you're showing up in the world with your people or your family or your neighbors or what have you? Doesn't have to be rock climbing. It could be something where your feet are safely on the ground, and that's cool too. And if you don't have something like that, okay, stop and reevaluate, because life is too short not to have some things that really fill us up with that, the kind of joy that you're seeing right here.
Well, I think what we both do, and your point is so valid, because I have coached hundreds and taught thousands. I can't think of one instance where somebody came back and said, I learned to rock climb because of you. However, here's what I learned from the lessons you brought when you spoke of the mountain. They immediately, it's a very simple and accessible metaphor.
Yep.
You don't have to be on a mountain to recognize it when you're 18,000 feet. You're going to have to take some deep breaths. But what I love about rock climbing, where you were going with this, the way it relates to business, when you're on the mountains and you're on a rock, there's no options. You either have to go up or you have to go down. It's one or the other. It's binary. And when we're in business, decisions have to be made. Sometimes if you make no decision, you're going to fall off that cliff. So the proverbial cliff. And I bring that same resonance, that same metaphorical spirit. Here we are. This is where we are on the mountain. That's where we want to be. There are many paths to get there.
Yep.
Let's discuss, and it may be a debate, and sometimes it's very passionate. Let's discuss which path we're going to take. We don't have the luxury of debating it. So we're going to have to come to conclusions very quickly, because on the mountain, you get beaten by weather. In business, you get beaten by the competition,
Absolutely.
Which means standing still at camp is only good for the opportunity to get your heads together, unify the efforts of your team, and then get together, even though you may not agree on everything, you're going to have to advance. It's all in the advancement. That's what I learned at Bloomberg in my many years when I became a mountaineer. I related so many of the lessons that I learned from Mike is about you're advancing all the time. You don't have to be perfect. Not every step is going to be right. But if you learn from those mistakes along the way, the next time you're in a similar position, you're going to get it right. And the key to mountaineering and to business, get more things right than wrong. Get the right things right. Don't worry about screwing up on the things that just aren't that significant. So you are spot on, Chaney, about how we parallel the mindset we use to climb our careers and the mindset that we use to blend the skills and the ethic necessary to climb the mountain.
100%. So let's actually take that path of talking about Bloomberg. So we're going to downtime a little bit.
Of course.
in your career, back to when you were at Bloomberg, because I know pre-show we were talking about how formative it was, and you were there in some of the earlier days, and the impact of Michael Bloomberg's leadership and the culture. So share a little bit about what that experience was like and how it influenced you.
I'd be delighted. Thank you. When I reflect on how blessed I am, and sometimes it's better to be lucky than smart, I joined this company no one ever heard of when there were less than 200 employees. And to our listeners, to put it into perspective, it is now 20,000. When you join a company as the 190th employees and revenues are at 70 million, you're not exactly sure what you have. You're not a late stage startup. You're pretty well established, but you're not a big company. Nobody's ever heard of you. Yet here we were with this incredible guy who had amazing vision, but it wasn't that he was this charismatic guy and he had all these things to say. He was in the trenches with us, very actively involved, and he was there to help 190 people succeed. And when he hired someone else, he was now helping 191. So you're in that early time. There is a great deal of discovery and experimentation because you're trying to find your foothold like a mountaineer in the landscape.
Yep.
And so my early days were just driven by a tremendous ambition. But what I learned most about it was that the two things were critical. One was the alignment of your action and your words.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have the luxury of getting that wrong. You might have gotten other things wrong, but when you're a small company and everybody is counting on everybody, you are what you do, not what you say you do. So when you're like a good football team and the play is called, you got to be where it is people expect you to be. That was the first thing. The second thing I learned, which I wish colleges would teach this, but they don't, and I try as best I can in teaching in my college experience, it's about execution. You can have great ideas. You can sit around and think great thoughts. You can be a damn genius. But if you can't move the ball, you are of no value in that company. It's stop thinking, stop overdoing everything, and get out there and try something.
Yeah.
And it didn't have to be perfect, but it had to be a continual series of increments that made you a little bit better every day. And so the lessons that I learned from Mike, just the inspiration, the freedom to succeed, the freedom to fail. You could not do anything or you had the freedom as long as you were honest and you were competent. You could try things 100 ways to Sunday, because generally when you were that active in your approach to trying to innovate your approach to how to win business, we're all each other's teachers. Everybody, we were all learning from each other as toward the effective methods of how to execute a plan. No business plan survives the first day. Adjustments begin immediately. And Shani, think about every mountain we've been on.
Yeah.
Not what we expected. Hey, it wasn't supposed to snow. Well, it's a blizzard. Same thing. Just the unexpected occurs instantly. What I learned about Bloomberg was just business is a continual series of adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
Be bold, but never reckless. And when you make that leap or that big step, take a pause, make sure there's others with you or you're with others. You align your efforts, you unify, and you move. A couple days later, assess the situation, move again. That's what I learned, and it was wonderful to do it. And I think back every day how lucky I am to have worked for that organization for so many years. And now as an executive coach, I coach there. So I get the opportunity to really bring what I learned in that organization to coach people in the same organization, even though it's 20,000 people later and 11 billion in revenue later.
I love it. And, you know, one of the things you said about, you know, execution isn't about getting it perfect. It's about going and trying and learning and continuous improvement. And too many people think that execution is about perfect, and it's really not. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, I also coach a lot of executives. I did a group coaching what do you call it, class, Zoom experience earlier this year that I called perfectionism detox. To try and pull the perfectionist out of people who suffer from it. And you know, because it's really just a variation of fear, and you know, get them to understand where that fear is coming from and release it. And anyway, so I completely agree with you, and I love the bit about aligning your actions and words is the most important thing. That's accountability. That's impeccability with your word. There's dependability. There's so much in that.
Yeah, I think also it's the greatest source of disappointment when you see someone not living up to those values.
Mm-hmm.
Because even no matter where you are in the evolution of your company or where you happen to be heading up the mountain, if someone doesn't do what they said they were going to do, it, the ripple effect on the people that needed it in order to support the chain of events can be huge. And I think my greatest source of disappointment is when I see someone who is just indifferent to not doing what they said they're going to do, and how it ruins credibility and respect. And I don't need to be with a genius. I just want to be with someone I can count on. That has 100 times more value than the brains. Yeah. And I think, Shani, what I try to instill in my own world is the conventional model of cram, exam, regurgitate. Oh my God, I think back to all of the time that I spent because I thought that was so important. And even in my college days, I thought, oh my God, I got an A. The world doesn't give a damn whether I got an A, an A minus, or a B, but the world cares immensely that I did what I said I was going to do.
Yep.
So I think for all of us, particularly in your practice with the leader shift, and I love that because what are we shifting to? One simple principle, align actions in words. You either fulfill expectations or you shatter them. Everything else is secondary. That has to be first.
Yep. And if you know you're off track from fulfilling expectations, part of it is communicating about it and resetting expectations before they become shattered.
I will be the first to admit that sometimes if I have failed to align action and words, I get it out very fast. I apologize. I said I was going to do A. I didn't. Doesn't matter why I didn't. But here's what I'm doing about it to reframe and to reset how I'm getting back on that trail. And when you do that and you establish a habit of always communicating if something is misaligned, I love it when people tell me that because we're all human. No worries. You know, something happened in the family. You got your car was delayed. All good. Just tell us that. Just communicate it. And as long as that happens, I think that's what great leaders do. They communicate often. They reframe continually expectations because we're constantly adapting to the world around us. And if we get that right, you got a great leader.
Oh, totally. So I want to shift for a moment to your role as a professor at Columbia University. And from what I remember, you teach emotional intelligence in the school, not to MBAs, to engineers.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
And as someone who's worked with my fair share of left brain people like engineers and you know, coders and tech companies and of course, investment bankers and lawyers and so forth, I'm curious to hear how you have found ways to break through the armor and also just the perceptions that emotional intelligence is soft.
Oh, indeed. Well, what if nothing else, I think you and I both stand on the pillars that we expose the hard truth about the soft skills.
Absolutely.
But my Columbia experience, actually, it started very innocently where a friend of mine was at Goldman Sachs. He was a financial engineer and a graduate of the Columbia Financial Engineering Program. And in graduate school of engineering, there are 11 majors. Financial engineering is one of them. There's chemical and electrical and everything else. And he felt that the Columbia alumni had to do a better job of explaining to the people who were in the program what was life really like when you get out of school. Mm-hmm. So he had, and I had been on stage for dozens of years, and he knew me by reputation. We worked together at BlackRock, and he asked me to come and give a guest lecture to 350 financial engineers on the importance of communication. And what he said is the engineers that I worked with in my BlackRock days, the ones that I valued the most could take complex matters and communicate them with simplicity. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of time, if an engineer is not talking to an engineer, it is a real gift and an enormous benefit to speak to a non-engineer in ways that they can understand. So when I got in front of the class, I had just released my book called The Climb to the Top, which is a communications framework for public speaking. But it's really a framework for how we communicate, how we speak with purpose and listen with intent. I developed it in all of my years at Bloomberg Public Speaking on stages. And what I found is the framework in the book I use the way we're speaking right now, mm-hmm. the way I'm pausing, trying to be clear, not rushing, same thing. So as I communicated a class to these engineers, many of the administrators are there and said, what else do you do? What else you got? And I said, well, what do you mean? And said, can we buy you lunch? And they did. And they said, and they explained to me, we have a problem we need to fill. Columbia engineers, a huge percentage of them are recruited out of campus, and they go to all the firms you'd expect. And many of the firms had called Columbia and said, two observations. One, you're sending us excellent engineers. Two, they're getting stuck mid-career, because the further that they ascend or they try to ascend on the career mountain, the less engineering they're going to do. Yep. They're going to lead, they're going to communicate, and they're now in a job description that is unfamiliar terrain to them, and they haven't adjusted sufficiently, and they're not doing a very good job. It's not their fault. No one ever taught them. They were simply told, just be a better engineer. So they focused their professional development on engineering, left brain. Well, now they are beginning to shift because their ambitions say, I want a leadership position. I want to do things that ascend me on the mountain. And if you ask any of the great CEOs or engineers, how much time do you spend engineering? None. In the evolution, it's a trade-off between less engineering, more leading. So Columbia then said to me, our feedback from the employers is we need a what they call professional development and leadership program at Columbia. We need guys like you who have a particular subject matter expertise, who are not career academics, but definitely are very good teachers. And so there were three or four of us, my friends, my big brother's a crisis manager, communications manager, like me, he's on faculty. And we created a program 4 years ago about helping the engineers develop communications. In my case, my graduate work was in emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. And the reason EQ is important, as an executive coach, I've worked on two succession plans. I have helped the board of directors and the current CEO identify what are the characteristics in the 2010s, now we're in 2021, that employees want out of their CEO. Here they are. Number one, they want their CEO to exhibit grace under fire, someone who can stay calm under the weight of enormous expectations. Number two, any CEO will tell you they spend more than half their time in conflict resolution. So what do people want? Someone who's good at resolving conflict. Mm-hmm. Number three, Shaney, they want someone who exhibits an empathetic leadership style. Now, when you consider these three, what have we not heard? Where'd you go to school? What was your GPA? What's your IQ? In fact, what we're measuring is EQ. So I use that as a guidepost to the engineers. And you don't have to have the ambitions to run Google, but I ask them, I have like a couple hundred in my class. How many of you have entrepreneurial ambitions? A couple hundred hands go up. You're going to be a CEO. Think about the pillars of how you're going to lead. I'm not asking or expecting you to be any less than an engineer. I would never expect someone to lower the performance expectation of your skill set. Mm-hmm. However, that's half your capacity. The other half of the capacity is where we lead. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you're saying you want to do, I'm here to help you develop those skills. To some who are closed-minded, they have closed mindset. Yep. Okay. But many of them, when they begin to see the possibilities, and it's like light bulbs. Oh, I didn't know. I just thought you'd become a better engineer. Well, you can be a better engineer, which is good, but it's a different competency. It's a different set of competencies. So my Columbia experience, I'm blessed for that. It's a wonderful institution, so dedicated to the career development of their students. And I'm blessed to play a part in that. But when I teach the soft skills to many of them, where it's uncomfortable, they didn't know it mattered. All of a sudden, like, wow, like just shining lights, like, oh. And then they go out and they call me a couple years later. Thank you so much for making us aware. I didn't know. Now I get it. I see exactly the guidepost that you establish for how we're going to climb the career mountain is half left, half right. That's our brain. And if we're going to operate at full capacity, you need that. You need one more thing, the heart. Because your brains are good. Your heart is the emotional factor by which you're going to connect with people that lead you to the credibility, the trust, and the respect, called the CTR factor. That factor, which was coined by an engineer who was on my radio show, his name is Suri Surinder. And Suri wrote a book called the CTR factor. He is an engineer who became the CEO of a huge operating division of Verizon. He explained, I was the engineer just like those guys. And as I climbed the mountain, oh my God, this is nothing like what I expected. So the experience there is a wonderful thing, if nothing else, to reveal the reality of the marketplace and what the market demands from the people who step into it. And I think it's wonderful. You and I both go to work in the service of others' success, but we bring that hard truth about soft skill sensibility.
Yes.
And not because one is ignorant to it, but because they really don't appreciate its importance because they haven't been there. And I think that's part of our responsibility to review.
It is. And, you know, and I think it's they haven't been there and or it hasn't been communicated to them in a way they can hear it.
Correct.
Right. Which for years was a problem in corporations because the soft skills were being delivered by people who didn't think had the credibility, you know, like it was people who grew up in HR or were a little too woo-woo or hippie or, you know, whatever. And then you started getting people like us who were revenue producers and leaders, and we made the tough decisions. We led in there in shoes like the ones they're wearing, and now we're saying this stuff, and they're choosing to take us more seriously for whatever reason. And B, I think we also have the ability to say it in ways that meet them where they are so they can hear it, internalize it, and start to practice it as opposed to it just being like, oh, you know, that's for hippies. It's not.
No, I think I appreciate your point is valid. I believe now here we are in 2021. It's taken its place. People respect it. They appreciate it. Look at the great CEO, Sundar Pichai at Google, just a wonderful human being, the way he communicates with such empathy and love. You know, it doesn't mean you're any less tough.
No.
You just don't have to be a jerk about it.
Totally.
Right. The days of
like Brene Brown says, like being vulnerable is actually one of the most brave things you can do.
No question. And she even says you can choose comfort or you can choose courage and you can't choose both.
That's right.
And I know when we help people to learn how to be better communicators, they are completely freaked out at the thought of communicating in front of their peers. And when they embrace it and they open their mind to it, they have exhibited the courage right then and there. And then when they find out that the sun's going to come up tomorrow, oh, I can actually build on this.
Exactly. And most people appreciate the honest feedback.
Absolutely. And they recognize I don't have to be perfect. You don't. But right. you have to, but be empathetic, help people to understand. And I think for us, I've been there. I didn't always do it right. I know exactly how that feels. So I empathize with them and I want them to be able to feel that this matters. And if we can do that, we're going to build a world of pretty good empathetic leaders in the future, I hope.
Absolutely. Well, before we go, I want to say, folks, you don't have to be getting your master's in engineering at Columbia to access some of Chuck's wisdom, because more recently he's been able to put this content online into a class or a course called Emotional Intelligence Lab. So just quickly tell us how people can find that.
You bet. You can find it on my website. My website is chuckgarcia.com. There is a tab called Engage. So if you just remember, I hope if you find me engaging, and I use that word because that's how people describe my classes. So if you just click Engage, you'll see something that says Courses. And the Emotional Intelligence Lab is two things. It's an online learning platform that's self-paced, but here's the beauty of it. There's a once a week Zoom call with me. And I coach you. So there's an active learning component that is live. So I hope if you go to it and then there's a contact tab, you can certainly register on chuckgarcia.com on the Engage tab. But otherwise, you can reach out to me and just hit the contact tab, send me a note. Love to hear from you.
Great. Chuck, any last parting words of wisdom before we call it a podcast?
I would. One last thing, Shani, and thank you for the opportunity to do it. I want everyone to consider in the 11th century, this wonderful poet, philosopher, priest, I'm not sure what he called himself. His name is Rumi. And he said something that I try to start every one of my classes with. And it goes like this. Yesterday, I was clever and I wanted to change the world. Pause for dramatic effect. Today, I am wise, so I am changing myself.
Mm-hmm.
To everyone listening who come to the world with an abundance of idealism, we love that about you. But if you want to change the world, all the power to you, I hope you do. But one thing I have learned, if you're going to change the world, you're going to have to start with changing yourself. As you climb the mountain of personal growth, I'm not just talking about what happens in the job.
Yep.
It's all mixed now. There is very little separation in our lives. Think about the ways in which you want to develop yourself. And when you think about the guidepost of a modern day CEO, empathy, conflict resolution, calm under pressure.
Yep.
My advice, tack toward that part of the wind that takes you up the mountain to that guidepost. It's not just a path to more success. I think it's a greater path to enlightenment and happiness.
You know, I usually close out the show, but what you just said is so perfect that I'm going to refrain. What Chuck said, folks.
Janie, thank you so much for the opportunity to collaborate with you. I look forward to hosting you on my show as well. And to our listeners out there, thank you for your time and your attention. But I am grateful to have been in the service of their success with you, Janie.
Likewise. Leadershifters, thanks for listening or watching. We'll see you next time.